Thanks so much for coming. Our next event will start momentarily. It's a great honor to host so many of you today at Stanford Law School. We're glad that so many of you were willing to take the time to come. My name is Theodore Fertschgott. I'm a 3L. And before we move on to the substance, I'd like to point out that somebody has lost a phone with a yellow covering. So, perfect. That was effective. Our next event is a fireside chat with Paul Graywall, the Chief Legal Officer of Coinbase, moderated by Katie Biber, the Chief Legal Officer of Brex. Both are very distinguished speakers. Paul previously worked in-house at Facebook and served as a U.S. Magistrate Judge in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California, and practiced patent litigation. He earned his Bachelor of Science from MIT and his JD from the University of Chicago, and clerked for Judge Sam Bell of the Northern District of Ohio and Judge Arthur Gajarza of the Federal Circuit. Before joining Brex, Katie served as general counsel of two companies, Anchorage and Thumbtack, and worked in-house at Airbnb. She was the general counsel of the Mitt Romney for President campaign back in 2012 and practiced election law and political law. She earned her BA from George Washington University, her JD from Harvard Law School, and clerked for Judge Timothy Timkovich in the 10th Circuit. So with that, I'll leave it to Paul and Katie.
I think this is on already. Okay, good. I was trying to push the button that actually says push, but it appears to do nothing. So Paul and I do not have a fireside. I brought the warm glow of my phone instead so I can receive Bitcoin price updates as we talk. Just waiting for more. I'll let you know if it crosses 65 during this 45 minutes.
Please do.
Yes.
More importantly, let me know if it falls to 35.
Then we can both run out the door to take corrective action, right? So really interested to talk with you, Paul, today because you've had two really interesting roles over the last couple of years. And I think going from Facebook to Coinbase is like going from crazy town to even crazier town. So would love to hear you compare and contrast what it's been like in these two roles, especially over the last year as you've been getting up to speed on the issues that Coinbase faces.
Sure, I'm happy to do that, Katie. First of all, I just want to say thank you to everyone for joining us today. This is a real honor and privilege to be with you. Crazy town and crazier town. I'm going to have to use that one, Katie. I had generally described my transition as much more frying pan and fire. But I think the concepts are similar enough to be useful. I was at Facebook for a little over 4 years at a very interesting time in that company's history. And my role there was focused on global litigation and regulatory affairs. And so had a chance to experience all that Facebook was going through, whether it was the election in 2016 and the aftermath of that company, Cambridge Analytica, obviously, and then all sorts of important issues that have reemerged in recent weeks concerning teen health and data privacy issues writ large. So it was not boring, and it was also, I think, compelling professionally and personally in that I think the company itself was going through a very significant transition in how it operated. Mm-hmm. The company had roughly 10,000 employees when I started. I'm guessing they're north of 75 now. So it was just a lot of change happening at that time in Facebook's history that gave me the opportunity to wrestle with a lot of the issues that we've been discussing today and will continue to discuss this afternoon. As far as jumping to Coinbase a little over a year ago, it is certainly true that by August of last year, crypto was already on everyone's mind, or nearly everyone's mind. But I think it's fair to say, and you can speak to this as well from your own professional experience, what we thought was a public awareness of public consciousness was just the very beginning, right? And so since that time, crypto is now has really emerged as not just an interesting industry issue and business issue, but a social one, and in some cases a moral one. And so, I have enjoyed navigating that, even as I've been trying to learn so much technology in such a short period of time, as well, in order to be useful in my current role.
So, despite the toehold that crypto's obviously gained in the American consciousness. The regulators are still operating on a little bit of an enforcement, regulation by enforcement tear. And I think we all know, you know, psychologically, we all know philosophically that when that type of thing happens, you have the sort of business equivalent of the First Amendment chill doctrine. But I'd love if you could talk about what it's like to actually live this, to live within the uncertainty of not knowing exactly how regulators might respond to a particular action.
Yeah. So look, regulation by enforcement is a controversial topic for some. I don't think it's particularly controversial in that, at the very least, I think we ought to be able to use common language to describe what is clearly the reality that the industry is facing today. I'm hopeful that we will start to see an alternative framework and model evolve, and that traditional rulemaking and public comment and consistent application will once again become at least the norm, if not the experience in every instance when it comes to crypto regulation. But right now, we have an environment in which enforcement actions are the way in which most actual companies trying to run their businesses understand what their obligations are. Mm. And sitting in the middle of all of that, I will say that while I'm not a huge fan of the model, to put it gently, what I think is more important and frankly a bigger concern, at least from my perspective, is that the incentives for a regime that relies upon enforcement actions first and foremost, I think are skewed from where they ought to be in order to get to the right result, mm-hmm. right? You have individual actors incented, I think, to take certain steps and pursue certain targets that may or not necessarily be the most important systemically, and that might also lead to either undercorrection or overcorrection of what are legitimate abuses in the industry and that need to be addressed.
Right, the idea that they might want to go after the best headlines, not necessarily going after the actions that are
I think that's generally right. I don't like to ascribe motives to any individual agency or any prosecutor or any individual lawyer when choosing to exercise their authority mm-hmm. to bring an enforcement action. My experience from my public service was that the vast majority of people who join these agencies are doing so for the right reasons mm-hmm. with the noblest of intentions. I truly and genuinely believe that. But I do think that systemically, right, you have a problem when enforcement becomes your primary tool in your mm-hmm. kit. And it also, I think, reflects a certain failure on the part of the other parts of our government to exercise their responsibilities or meet their responsibilities to articulate what the rules are about certain financial products or mm-hmm. How exchanges ought to operate or any number of pretty fundamental basic questions that have not been answered when it comes to crypto.
So one of the things that Coinbase proposed actually I think just this week was that all regulation of crypto should be consolidated into one agency. Would that solve this problem of regulation by enforcement, or would it at least collect the best minds on these regulatory issues in one place?
I would love to think that our proposal that we rolled out last week would solve the problem. I'm also
problems.
I'm self-aware enough to know that that is clearly not true. But I do think that, part of the problem that we're talking about here is fragmentation, right? You have different agencies in the federal government all, again, acting in, in good faith to try to get to the right result, and from my perspective, grasping at issues which clearly overlap, and overlap tends to lead to inconsistency. Mm-hmm. I also think there is an issue that your question alludes to of expertise and dispersion of expertise. Crypto is freaking hard. It's hard to understand technically. The rules around what constitutes adequate transparency, what constitutes appropriate reserves, all the questions that are bubbling around us right now require a level of sophistication that I think is fairly unique, even if others may say that there are hard questions in all sorts of areas.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a really underdescribed practical problem, I think. The industry itself is vacuuming up so much of the terrific talent that it's very hard for regulatory agencies, especially given what they can pay, to find people who have the relative expertise.
I'm super sympathetic to that. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the fact of the matter is, right, the white paper is only so old, and so expertise in this area is pretty limited. I do think that the agencies have an issue retaining the best talent, mm-hmm. and I think we need to respect that. But I also think that focusing on a single regulator, while it may create other issues that we have to understand and unpack, has the benefit of concentrating expertise and developing a certain rhythm and hum to regulation that allows correction when there is, you know, either under or overshooting. And right now, with a fragmented approach like the one that we have in place, I don't see that, you know, being addressed anytime soon.
Well, maybe your retirement gig can be to go be the czar of this agency.
Well, I would welcome any opportunity to contribute, but I think I've taken enough zigs and zags in my career, as the introduction suggested, for one lifetime.
So, you know, we talked a little bit about regulation by enforcement, and, you know, one of the things that the American crypto industry has been talking a lot about lately is how this uncertainty is actually driving amazing projects, really cool technology, overseas. So I think a two-part question mm-hmm. here. Number one, do you, like me, see that actually happening? And number two, what do you think the actual effects are for America, America's place in the world economy, America's place as, you know, one of the most important technological centers?
Yeah. I mean, so to answer your first question, I think that migration threat is not just theoretical. Mm-hmm. It's very real. I mean, the fact of the matter is that if you compare the regulatory experience here in the United States to other jurisdictions, at least certain other jurisdictions, I don't think the rest of the world entirely has figured this out either. There is just much more certainty in other places, and capital tends to follow certainty or at least focus on it.
Shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, right? So, you know, who knew? Who knew that, you know, clear rules and a consistent level of engagement
by the
regulators.
We like to call it the rule of law, actually.
Yes, I think that was the way it was originally described, you know, by the founders. No, I think that issue is very real, and I don't think that we should delude ourselves into thinking that we can take steps or actions here that don't have knock-on effects or follow-on effects, including mm-hmm. the migration of talent and capital. As for what it means for the U.S.'s place in the world as crypto becomes more prominent, you know, that's probably a question that's slightly above my pay grade, but I will offer my view, which is that you know, the default assumptions that have governed our financial system for the last 50 years, basically, or more, since the end of World War II, I think are all under, you know, they're not necessarily under assault, but they're being seriously questioned by mm-hmm. countries all over the world that wonder, you know, whether the United States will continue and should continue to play a leading role in setting the standards. And the fact of the matter is, if we don't get our act together, there are no shortage of alternatives out there and actors and countries that want to take on that role.
No doubt true. So let's talk about the nuts and bolts of what it means to get our act together,
sure.
I guess. So Coinbase just released this awesome framework of regulatory proposals.
I think it's kind of awesome, but I appreciate your saying that. Yeah.
So what do you think are the most important parts of this? Like what parts of the law is it most critical for us to get right?
Yeah. So we've already talked a little bit about a key pillar in our regulatory framework proposal, which is unification or at least integration of the regulatory scheme under a single agency or entity. Mm-hmm. We have taken no view on which agency or entity that should be. I think that's actually a much more interesting and hard question than some want to admit. But I do think that integration and unification is super, super important. I'll just call out one or two other kind of key elements of the proposal that I think are worth paying attention to, even if you disagree with it. Well, the first thing I will say is that we put out a proposal in writing, an invited comment, and put it up on GitHub for people to offer their own views on if that's what they want to do. I think that this simple step of staking out ground and taking a position and inviting discussion shouldn't be controversial, shouldn't be particularly novel, but I think actually is in the current climate. And that saddens me greatly, because the fact of the matter is, if we cannot have reasoned debate, even where we have disagreements about particular elements of the policy, if people feel incented to try to withhold or their explicit positions on, you know, whether or not we ought to have an industry regulator, whether or not we ought to have self-regulation in some form, whatever the case may be, I think that's bad for the industry, and it leads to less than optimal outcomes. But the other substantive element of our proposal, I think that's very, very important to Coinbase, but hopefully important to others as well, is the idea that we have some structure that allows experimentation and innovation, right? So, you know, right now, there hasn't been a lot of, there hasn't been a lot of forward momentum or progress from Commissioner Pierce's proposal for a safe harbor, as one example. Now, I don't know if the safe harbor is the only way to, you know, create room for innovation and experimentation, but the concept, I think, is pretty darn important.
It's pretty sound.
Pretty sound. I think pretty well understood. Mm-hmm. And it allows us, it also reflects a certain humility, right? That none of us really know what the right balance is on these various topics, but unless we run these experiments and see how they play out in the real world, unless we can sort of evaluate what it means to have a sufficiently decentralized organizational structure, so long as we are, you know, willing to see, you know, what it means to have an expectation of profits play out over 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, and so forth, we're not going to get to the right result.
Yeah, and Commissioner Peirce in particular has been a real hero standing up for just clarity, basic concepts of clarity. She recently also stood up and said, you know, the crypto industry is not the Wild West that people think it is. There's a lot of good actors here trying to make the world a better place, but unfortunately she is just the one person. How do we get past the congressional gridlock to, you know, to say the least for anything else? But the congressional gridlock is going to be a major problem for even the creation of a new agency.
Yeah, well, and to be clear, I think, you know, the hope that a new agency would be created by this Congress is an ambitious one. I recognize that. But again, the point was to start the conversation. Yeah. How do we get Congress moving in a certain productive direction, even if the details may be, you know, such that we disagree? I think the most important thing starts with the education. And I know, Katie, you've been involved in these issues mm-hmm. for a long time. We are still dealing with a fairly elementary or basic baseline of understanding of how crypto works, what it is, what it isn't, among large swaths of the Congress. It's not for lack of interest or lack of capacity, certainly, but I think we have more work to do. In the crypto space, we tend to focus on those members and senators who have really embraced these issues and run with it. Mm-hmm. They are in a distinct minority. And so I think education is where we need to start.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I've been thinking a lot about recently is how we can do a better job explaining the practical applications of this technology. Just because, you know, in the mid-90s, in the late 90s, you didn't have lobbyists going into Congress talking about the internet by ripping open the side of a computer and showing the motherboard the staffers. And I think we do a lot of that, talking mm-hmm. about the technology in a very minutiae sort of way mm-hmm. without focusing on the concept of Web3 and the idea that this technology really benefits a lot of people in pretty meaningful ways.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the way we move past that, right, is to first of all acknowledge that most asset classes and most markets tend to follow a certain trajectory, mm-hmm. right? So for example, you know, we have focused at Coinbase in our first phase on trading. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that trading tends to drive a lot of innovation in new asset classes, and we've seen this since the beginning of time. Broader financial products and services beyond trading are now starting to take shape. We're quite enthusiastic and excited about that, but we're still in the relatively early days. And then crypto as a platform is sort of the ultimate goal, that we can fundamentally rewire how a lot of our social and economic systems work based on the blockchain. I think that's a hugely ambitious opportunity for us, our idea. But we need to talk about these in real terms. How does this translate to, what does it mean for what I can do with my debit card? Right? What does it mean for my ability to get insurance? Is this going to help me be able to start a new small business in an underserved community? Unless we can speak in those terms, all of this is going to feel very nebulous.
Agreed. Right? Yeah, I think that's really the most important part for us to show the promise of what it is we're doing here. So, you know, there are definitely some haters, for lack of better terminology,
one or two.
In D.C.
Yeah.
What is it that they hate? And let's try to be charitable and not build a straw man that we murder in the street here.
Sure.
What is it that they don't like, and what can we do to answer those concerns?
Yeah. Why do they hate us? I think is the thrust of your question. I think hate is even, you know, again, in the spirit.
Misunderstand.
Correct. In the spirit of your question, probably too strong a term.
Right.
Yeah. I think it is a misunderstanding. Well, I think the technology first and foremost is daunting. Mm-hmm. And I say this as someone who has spent my entire career working in high tech and law. I think blockchains and crypto more generally are as hard a set of technologies as any mm-hmm. to understand, certainly from a public policy perspective. And I think look, to be fair, I think to be fair to those who have expressed concerns or criticized what they've seen out of the crypto space so far, I don't think we've done ourselves any favors as an industry in continuing to shroud a lot of our objectives in a lot of language that sounds scary and off-putting, at least to certain parts of our government. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a certain knowledge gap we have to close, and then I think we also have to be candid and transparent that some of the hostility, right, just maybe a little bit of it, reflects a certain attachment to vested entrenched interests that will, I think, face a lot more competition and a lot more scrutiny in a more open system like the one crypto promises. So I think you have to sort of look at all of these different explanations as opposed to any one of them.
Agreed. So we're at a Federalist Society event. Would love to hear.
I can tell.
The logo gives it away.
The logo is the dead giveaway. Yeah.
So why should the average conservative or libertarian be pro-crypto? Let's get down to the philosophy of it and tell us a little bit about how you think about the political theory of it and why people who are generally aligned with the Federalist Society should appreciate the emergence of crypto and Web3.
So I'll say that I think the most compelling reasons are reasons that anyone should be interested in crypto if you are concerned about the state of our economy and the state of our system. And I don't use grand language like that lightly, but the fact of the matter is that crypto was born of an ethos of personal and individual freedom. There's no question about that. And if you study the history of, especially the first 3 to 5 years of crypto, right, it was very much rooted in this notion that people should have control over their resources, unless there is a legitimate and important reason otherwise, the government shouldn't have a front row seat to the activities of its citizens. And I think that the most important and compelling reason, again, that I think hopefully should appeal to a wide swath of the spectrum, is that there are, I think, really interesting opportunities, medium and long term, for crypto to improve the state of our republic and the health of our democracy, whether it's voting systems, whether it's social networks that allocate the value of the network to users as much as to those that build and run them. There are a whole host of other ways in which I think crypto can address some of the concerns that this audience and I would suggest others have about where our country stands.
There's so much there. We could do 3 hours talking about that topic.
I do it every day, so I'm
part
game.
Two. So your boss, the CEO of Coinbase, had a very public moment about a year ago when he declared that Coinbase was a mission-focused company and should be a politics-free zone. I mean, you came from a company that was obviously quite political.
A little bit different.
Very different philosophies. Yes. So what has the year been like as sort of as this policy manifests itself? What has it meant to the way Coinbase operates? What has it meant for Coinbase's productivity and, its employee base?
Yeah, so Katie is alluding to is a blog post that Brian Armstrong, our CEO, put out. If not in my first week, it felt like my first week. It was right after I joined the company last summer. And it essentially staked out Coinbase's view of how politics should play or not play in the workplace. And the thrust of it, and you captured it exactly right, was that unless certain topics, social topics, political topics, or otherwise, related to the operation of the business, and of Coinbase in particular, or at least crypto, we were not going to engage in a way that many other companies, certainly tech companies, have always engaged when they felt enough pressure either internally or externally. So for me, in week one or whatever it was a bit of a tumult, right? Because I had come from this business culture where the company was very much focused on staking out its place in the world and giving voice to certain political views that it felt it could add some weight to. And I don't criticize Facebook for that in this one particular way. I think that every company has not just a right, but an obligation to adopt a point of view and to act consistently with that when it comes to making a decision about whether to weigh in on a particular state bill in Georgia or Texas or a Supreme Court case that may be coming up before the justices. For me, the most enlightening part of the experience was the fact that we did put out our position in writing for the world to see, not just for our employees, but for anyone who was interested in these issues. And it, as you suggest, Katie, it did draw, you know, a fair bit of blowback, at least initially. I was surprised by that as much as anything, because the thrust of the message was, here's who we want to be. If you share this view of the world and you want to focus on, wait for it, work at work, as opposed to other stuff at work, come join us. Come join us from whatever corner of the universe you come from. We don't care who your parents were. We don't care what school you went to. If you want to be part of this, we want you here. That seems to me to be a very open, welcoming message as much as anything, and yet I think there were certain characterizations of it as something much less than that.
Yeah, what I found interesting about it is it appeared, at least to this outsider, like it was not an overly workshopped, committee-written message. This clearly came from your CEO, like, you know, frankly, many of the best things out of a company. Was that true?
Yeah. Look, Brian is very much of a hands-on CEO. Mm-hmm. As his general counsel and chief legal officer, I appreciate the fact that he picks up the pen and speaks with his own voice and doesn't want a committee of lawyers or others, as you say, workshopping or massaging messages to basically appeal to the lowest common denominator. This was something he felt deeply and personally and wanted to speak in his own voice. And so, did it reflect what, a room full of lawyers might have put out in order to, take the worst edges off from the perspective of some? No.
I'm sure the average GC would have wrung their hands at the notion of that going out.
A little bit. But I honestly think that part of its power and its impact was the fact that it was from him, in his voice, with his own words. And a year later, I will say, if it wasn't the most important decision that the company made and that he made in the last year, it was in the top three or four, five. It was transformational for us as a company, even as we had to work through some short-term choppiness in terms of public reaction.
So let's talk about the other side of the coin here. Mm-hmm. What does a company look like, and you don't have to pick any particular company, but what does a company look like when it becomes enmeshed in employee activism, when it becomes too much about politics?
Well, I think the biggest challenge with that alternate model, right? And again, I want to be clear. I think if that is a model that the company has settled upon and has decided is in, not just the shareholder interest, but the stakeholder interest writ large, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, in that situation, having seen it, a lot of executive time is focused on issues which are ancillary to the operation of the business. A lot of time, right? The leadership of any company, certainly a tech company, is not generally thinking about legislation that has nothing to do with its business, or a Supreme Court case that may pop that hasn't been on their radar. And so the time and energy and resourcing required in order to adopt a point of view and then promote it is, I just can't understate it. It is huge. The other thing that it does is it draws you into a discussion and really an ongoing dialogue about why issues that are worthy of executive and company time and attention are promoted, and all sorts of other issues are not, right? And you can imagine, right, especially if you're operating as a national company, even more so if you're operating as an international company, there are just infinite social and political topics that corporate leadership could weigh in on. And maybe if we were in a business where our job was to sort of mine the store and keep the trains running reasonably on time, that would be feasible. We're trying to avoid getting crushed by a brutally competitive market every single day. And so for Coinbase, I think the issue was as much about focusing our energy on where we thought we could have the biggest impact, mm-hmm. and discharge our duties and avoid getting pulled into these issues that were much more of a distraction.
Coinbase, like a lot of companies, has actually started hiring much more remotely. I think almost every job at this point is remote eligible.
Right? We are, yeah.
Yeah. How has that changed employee activism and talking about politics at the office?
Yeah, I think, it would be reasonable to conclude that as we distributed our workforce outside of certain parts of the country with a certain political profile, we would see a wider range of political views among our employees. But here's the thing, Katie, I can't answer your question because we don't talk politics at work. So I don't actually know whether or not I've got more of one type of employee or another. And I find that incredibly liberating. because it's not relevant to our mission as a company.
Awesome. Well, I want to talk about two really interesting theoretical questions, and then we're going to get to a lightning round before we ask a couple of audience questions. So let's talk about DAOs. Why don't you explain to our audience what a DAO is?
Sure. So a DAO is a decentralized autonomous organization. What it basically refers to is a group of people or entities, could be a couple, could be a couple thousand, who have elected to do productive work of one type or one form or fashion without traditional corporate structure, right? So in order to promote a new protocol for a new type of blockchain, one way to do that would be to go out and form an entity under Delaware law, raise capital from the usual suspects, hire people and manage them in a traditional way, and direct those resources, all of them, towards developing that particular protocol. Alternatively, with DAOs, you are relying upon the blockchain itself to create incentives for contribution. You can think of it as the open source movement that we're maybe more familiar with over the last 25 years or so on steroids, because you now have tokens available through the DAO, at least the concept is this, that reward people for contributions based on the collective assessment of each of the members of the DAO. So that's a 30-second summary of a very complicated topic.
Yeah, there's some real crypto believers who think that every project or company created in the future will be a DAO. Do you think we're headed that way?
Every company, probably not. But I do think there is massive, massive potential for transforming how projects get run and products get built using DAOs. I absolutely believe that. Because I saw it with the open source movement. You know, I've been practicing in tech in one form or fashion for 25 years, give or take. And, you know, if you think back, for those of you who are around, I don't see a lot of them in this room, but there are a few of you, you know, to when the big debate in the software world was between Windows and Linux, right? And so there are absolutely historical precedents for this idea that people will take action collectively, but in a decentralized way, in order to promote technologies and advance projects forward. Mm-hmm. What DAOs and tokenization do, as I said, is juice that by saying, not only will you enjoy the professional or personal satisfaction of having done a good work and advanced the state of the art, you'll enjoy certain financial and other governance rewards that go with that. And I think that is going to be a very powerful concept to a lot of people who aren't interested in a W-2 and a desk and a badge.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about DAOs is there's a lot to be figured out still from a legal standpoint. I mean, what is this organization? Is it an association of some sort?
Yeah.
Is it sort of like a corporate entity? Who do you blame when something goes terribly wrong? What do you think we need to answer in order to make this a realistic future?
Yeah, I think sorting through those basic questions of governance and responsibility and attribution is super, super important. But look, you know, again, this is why I find history so valuable in so many different ways. These same questions were asked at the formation of the first stockholding companies.
Right.
Right. It was a very foreign concept for societies that were founded on artisanship, right? To imagine that you could create entities of artisans that would have independent standing and responsibility. If we sorted through that, I'm confident we can sort through these, but we have to kind of work through those issues on a one-by-one basis.
That's one of the most interesting things about being a lawyer in the crypto space, I think. Right now, we are figuring out those foundational legal questions that, you know, like the ones you read about in torts class or crim law, that are setting out basic questions that are going to be followed for centuries to come. So,
yeah, I think that's right. And you know, I think this is all getting sorted out now, which is why, you know, when I meet newer lawyers, I'm always encouraging them. Like, there is no area of the law more interesting right now and a bigger opportunity to have an impact than in crypto.
And it doesn't take any expertise yet, because there isn't really a body to learn.
No.
You just have to be smart and willing to work hard.
That's right. You're only at most a decade behind everybody
else.
Exactly.
So one more question, then we're going to get into my lightning round of questions. And this is a big one, so it may take us some time to work through.
Sure.
What role do you think blockchain or crypto can play in human rights issues, information access issues, things that we grapple with as a society all the time?
Yeah, that is a big one. Well, I have a couple of immediate thoughts on this. One is, I think that at its core, right? When we talk about human rights issues, we're talking about freedom of expression and freedom of identity. And that's how I think of it. That might be incomplete, but I think those are two big elements of what you're speaking of. And I think that blockchains offer huge potential, absolutely huge potential for promoting each of those ideas. Freedom of expression in the sense that there is a decentralization that is inherent in the architecture of every blockchain I'm familiar with, or at least most of them, that really does, I think, encourage individual expression and individual responsibility much more than the central technologies that we've spent the last 50 plus years building. Mm-hmm. Freedom of identity, well, you know, the fact is that it's not just about anonymity or a pseudonymous identity on the internet. It's just this idea that what your last name is, Katie, where I happen to have grown up, what my credentials are, don't matter, or at least matter a lot less if you're able to independently assess the credibility and validity of whatever it is you or I or anybody else is purporting. I just think that's incredibly liberating. And
to do it without that intermediary, that third
party,
or at least big tech company.
That's right. You're not relying upon companies sitting in Mountain View or Menlo Park or anywhere else to determine whether or not you are worthy of not just expression, but amplification or distribution. Mm-hmm. Those assessments are being made much more on the merits. And I think that is among the biggest potential that comes from blockchain.
Yeah, there's so much human autonomy that comes from owning your own information and being able to carry it from place to place.
Yeah.
That is going to be a big part of the Web3 trend, I think. So you think that someday we're all going to be hiding behind avatars, like this panel will...
Someday?
The version
of us
in the future will hide behind an avatar. You're paul.eth, I'm katie.eth, and we're just going to go from there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, we can shelter behind the Bored Apes and others.
I can't afford one of those. You probably can, but not me yet.
I think that day is quickly arriving.
Awesome. Okay, so let's get into a lightning round of questions. Number one, coolest company in crypto, and the answer is not Coinbase.
Okay, with that qualification, in case my boss is watching, I'm going to throw a compliment out to one of our competitors. I think FTX has done some amazing stuff. I think what Sam and his team have shown in terms of the ability to execute with a handful of engineers in a very short period of time is something really, really impressive.
Cool ads, too.
Super cool ads. Yeah.
Wildest potential application of blockchain technology?
Wildest? I would say that the blockchain, I think, can fundamentally change how we vote.
Ah.
And again, this is an opportunity, I think, that cuts across the political spectrum, because I think we're all aligned in the idea that we want voting systems that work and that accurately reflect individual intent. I think blockchains offer a huge potential there, but we're a few years away from that.
I think we are definitely a few years away.
Yeah.
But cool application. How often do you check the price of Bitcoin?
Honestly?
I've checked it twice during this panel.
Okay, you're probably two times ahead of me. I try to only check it maybe once a day.
Bold. Okay. How many years before you think there's going to be 90% crypto adoption, 90% plus crypto adoption in the United States?
In the United States, crypto adoption, I think we're going to see 90% 5 years. I really do.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm a couple of years off one way or the other, but...
That feels right.
Yeah, this is coming.
It's moving faster than people think.
Absolutely.
Realize, I think.
And I think, if I can just add one quick point,
yeah.
I think what's super interesting is that most of that adoption, I think, is going to come first in communities that have been traditionally excluded from the financial system.
Oh, 100%.
Which is why I'm super excited.
The unbanked and underbanked are the prime individuals should be taking advantage
because
of
because they get the most benefit from
That's
it
exactly
in the shortest
right.
period of time.
Yeah. Do you have an NFT?
I do not.
You need to fix that after this. You got to have an NFT. Okay. The first presidential election where crypto is going to be a big issue.
Oh, I think it's 2024.
Yeah, I think that's probably
right. I think we're there.
There will be a debate question in 2024 about
absolutely.
Crypto.
Absolutely.
Okay. Who is Satoshi? Is it Brian Armstrong?
I can't say that it's not Brian because I don't know, but it's not me. I can say that.
Noted. Okay. Would you ever buy Starbucks with crypto?
Yeah. I would.
You would deal with the tax ramifications for a cup of coffee.
I get it. The current tax hassle around that makes it a lot less desirable than any of us would want. But if we can solve that problem, I absolutely think a cup of coffee would be a good use case for crypto.
All right, what was harder to learn, crypto tech or crypto law?
Honestly, crypto tech. And, you know, I'm reasonably confident in my abilities to understand new technologies, and I have found it to be extraordinarily intimidating, just to be very honest about that.
It is very hard. It requires some real humility and commitment to learning, I think, the first time you enter the field.
Correct. Humility is a very good place to start when it comes to
just
learning. Just
flat out admitting I have no idea what you just said is one of the first, most important things you can do in conversation.
Indeed. You know the other thing, crypto engineers, they're so good at smelling fear.
They can smell fear for sure.
They're really good at it. So,
yeah, and they can ask questions more pointed than the best lawyer in a deposition.
It is an amazing cross-examination.
You don't
Absolutely.
Know what you're talking about in about 5 seconds.
That's up to what you don't know.
Yeah, exactly. All right, last question,
yep.
And then let's get some audience questions queued
sure.
up. So who are three regulators or policymakers that you think really get these issues, whether they agree with you or not?
Well, we've already spoken of Commissioner Peirce. I think she deserves a lot of credit for not just being sophisticated on these issues, but early. Right in the grand scheme of things, who else gets it? Look, I think there are staff members in parts of the state governments that you would never expect, who understand crypto far better than anybody would ever realize. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about people at the DFS, people in the Nebraska Department of Financial Regulation, or whatnot. There are just some incredible human beings out there that really are genuinely curious about this and have impressed me. The third example of somebody I think who really gets crypto, I thought Senator Toomey, along with Senator mm-hmm. Wyden, really showed leadership in the infrastructure bill, and more than leadership, a real sophistication about issues that I don't think they had spent a ton of time on before, but boy, were they smart. So credit to both of them.
Yeah, they got the philosophical underpinnings of it pretty quickly. And even though I think many people would say the crypto industry, quote unquote, lost that battle ultimately, it certainly showed just how loud the industry is going to be in the future and will hopefully shape policy debates later on.
Yeah. And I think it also showed a new model of engagement that Washington is only starting to get their heads around.
No, we are so far beyond call your congressperson. And I think that this industry and the supporters of it are going to make a lot of noise in the future.
No question about it.
All right. Well, I think we probably have some audience questions if folks want to queue up at the microphone. One of my favorite rules for conferences is your question should take one breath and it should end with a question mark. So if
we
could try
that.
To stick to that, that would be awesome. But if you could also introduce yourself at the beginning of the question, that would be great.
Okay, Mike Martin, I'm an attorney at Yahoo, and my question is about liquidity as a liquidity providers of last resort, which is to say that one of the characteristics that seems shared across these cryptocurrencies is that they're against the manipulation, right, of fiat currency. So has Coinbase or anybody else given thought to what we're going to have, how we're going to solve the problem when there's a liquidity crisis?
Well, I think the short answer is we've given a lot of thought to that, and others have as well. I don't know that anyone has a single answer to solve that very big question. Look, I think that the most important element here is transparency around how these markets are operating, and so that people going in understand what constraints may be may be present when there is a particular crunch. I think there's a lot more we can do, frankly, as an industry around that. And so that's one area where I'm hoping with the right regulatory framework in place, we can make some progress. I think the other thing that's really, really important is, again, I keep coming back to history, mm-hmm. right? Other asset classes offer many examples of liquidity crisis, and some of us have lived through a few of those in our professional careers. And I think it's really, really important to understand, what contributed to those issues and where crypto can offer a unique solution. Because I'm completely in the camp that Katie alluded to earlier of we need to show that we can do this better for there to be that 90% adoption. Just being as good or good enough isn't going to cut it to get to that last tranche of users.
Dan Wheeler, CEO of Sunstone Trust Company. Question to both Katie and Paul would be, what risks or downsides do either of you see to the digital dollar if it's implemented on a centrally controlled blockchain?
Well, I'll offer a thought or two, but I'd love to get your views too, Katie. Look, the biggest challenge I see with an effective digital dollar, and I use those words very specifically and carefully, is, again, I come back to expertise. I fundamentally worry that if we have a public blockchain or project that is exclusive of any private industry input, we're just not going to have the technology expertise necessary in order to build these systems in a robust, scalable, and safe way, and secure way. So I think, though, that if we can figure out the public-private partnership model around that, there's a real opportunity for a digital dollar that could work. The other thing I think that's very, very important is that if the digital dollar, at least as I have understood the variety of proposals that are being floated out there, sits alongside of other coins, stable coins and others, that compete for market adoption and acceptance, I think there could be a real, you know, opportunity to see best practices proliferate across all those projects. What I'm much less excited about personally is a situation either here in the US or outside of the US where digital currencies are to the exclusion of private alternatives, mm-hmm. and we snuff out that opportunity to figure out how this stuff should work.
So I'm of a couple of different minds on this. I think, first of all, having a digital dollar is really critical for America's supremacy, and for the dollar to remain supreme, we need to have a digital dollar. That said, there are a lot of pretty good alternatives right now, a lot of dollar peg stable coins that are getting the job done, and I would hate to see us do this China style, where we take down the concept of private stable coins in the interest of having a digital dollar. That would be against every sort of concept of crypto ethos that all of us embrace. But I do think that this is something that needs to be created in the future. I do worry about the expertise issues that you worry about. I mean, everything that the government has built so far with respect to payments infrastructure has been, you know, sort of less than what the private industry would build. But it's something that we do need.
Yeah, just one other quick point on this. I think that to the extent that the digital dollar is viewed as a way of extending or at least preserving the dollar supremacy as the world's reserve currency, I can understand the impulse and I embrace it and support it. I want to see the dollar continue to play a significant role in our financial systems globally. I actually think the private stable coins offer a way to do that in a much more efficient and effective way, because the fact of the matter is the vast majority of them are backed by the US dollar above all other fiat currencies.
Yeah, we do need to get some basic policy issues squared. I mean, obviously, the concern of the regulators with some stable coins has been that their reserves are insufficient. That is simply not okay, obviously, but...
I agree.
But once that issue's solved for, yeah, I agree.
Yep.
Hi, good afternoon. Edward Hurst from Hurst Technology and Trade. Thank you very much for coming. I will say I'm also the founder of the Berkeley chapter of the Federal Society. So down here in Stanford, I'm still happy to see it happening. I recently left the Treasury Department, and one of the things I observed there is that a lot of what drives crypto policy is what occurs in the G7, G20 meetings, and not just in those meetings, but the very fact that the U.S. government needs to develop unified positions for those meetings. The issues come up all the time in those at the top levels. And I didn't see much activity from the crypto community with respect to those meetings, maybe because they don't perceive how much those drive things. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how the crypto community in the policy sense can be more active in G7, G20, APEC, the different multilateral economically focused meetings.
I think it's a fair critique to raise. The fact of the matter is, you can observe the relative thrust and energy that have been directed elsewhere as compared to those entities. I think it's just about maturation, right? And the fact that we're still babies. We're maybe toddlers in the grand scheme of things compared to other industries, and not just in our absolute age, but in our sophistication and understanding of like where the right points of engagement are, not just here in the US, but globally. And I think, like, again, I've been at Coinbase for a little over a year. If I look back just in the 13 or 14 months I have been involved in this industry, there has been a massive acceleration in our appreciation of the importance and significance of these other points of contact with the world financial system, and the fact that we can't just focus all of our energy on the issue of the moment, right? We have to think much more strategically. I think you're going to see that be adopted much more widely.
Probably have time for one more question. Well, we wait for that. Just one more plug, similar to what Paul said before, for people who are interested to get into this industry. There are so many things available to students at Stanford or any other top law school, but I would urge you against going into one of these industries that is already rigidly built out, has so many rules of engagement, has so many rules of credentials. The crypto industry right now is so young and nascent that it still feels a little bit like a Western land grab, that the fastest person who's willing to work the hardest and learn the most can get out there and claim a big piece of land. And that moment is not going to last forever. And you still have a little bit of time left. So if this is of any interest to you at all, you should jump in head first.
Plus one to all of that. I can't say it any better.
All right, well, thank you, everyone.
Thank you.